It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. O'Malik joins Serenity Caldwell and the great John Graham coming to talk about the Time Warner Cable Comcast merger. Looks like it may actually go through. Is Google really evil? Our panel says absolutely. And we'll talk about the latest from ScriptKitties. It turns out they've got some real good new tools at their disposal. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 445, recorded February 16th, 2014. Shave My Dog. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. It's simple, honest, and easy to use. For 10% off your first purchase, visit hover.com/twit2 and use the offer code TWIT2. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Visit audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. And by FreshBooks, the simple cloud accounting solution that helps thousands of entrepreneurs and small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com and join over 5 million users running their businesses with ease. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, visit Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT2. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover all the week's tech news. And we have so much fun doing it, and I want to welcome our panel, a great panel. Kind of some people we haven't had on in a while. Of course, Serenity Caldwell, we love. All the way from Boston, where it's snowing.
It is, or full of snow. Not so much snowing anymore, but
MacWorld.com. She's also on the Incomparable podcast. I listened to that Christmas one after you were here last time.
What did you think?
Wow, Glenn Fleischman does some really good voices.
Yes, he does. And Andy Anatko.
Anatko, I knew Andy did. what fun that was. You did a play, a Doctor Who.
Yes, and a Doctor Who spinoff.
Yeah.
Pseudo homage.
Really fun. Anyway, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
And since you're stuck inside anyway, might as well. Also with us from GigaOM, the legendary O'Malik, the Yoda of tech journalists.
Really? That's what you're going to call me now?
You called me that once, and I figured turnabout is fair play.
Making me feel really old.
No, Yoda's not old. He's super smart, and he speaks backwards.
The only person who accuses me of that is my mother, and you're the second person.
Anyway, it's really nice to see you again. Haven't had you on in ages, and it's a shame. So we're glad to have you back. We do have many GigaOMers on all the time, including Matthew Ingram, we love. So great to have you back. Thanks for joining us, Om.
Thank you, Lee. Poor
Om will be compelled to hold his microphone for the entire show because we neglected to give him a stand he could use. But you sound marvelous.
I know.
Rich, beautiful.
Yeah. I feel like a broadcast journalist. Yeah. Right.
You're doing a stand-up in your apartment.
Yes.
I'm standing here in my apartment. You may wonder why. Also joining us from Great Britain, where are you, John?
I'm in a basement somewhere in London.
Joining us from a London basement, John Graham Cumming, who is a computer programmer. In fact, I first met him due to his anti-spam open source program, Popfile, which I use and loved. He also wrote we had him back when he wrote the Geek Atlas, which was a travel book for geeks with all the great places you should go. You may remember when he did the petition to apologize to Alan Turing. The British government did, in fact, apologize thanks to that petition. That's great.
Yep, they did.
And you've been building, and I think we contributed to this, Charles Babbage's analytical engine. Is that going on now? Are you building it now?
We're not actually building it. We're trying to figure out what he was actually going to build, given that he left tens of thousands of handwritten notes behind about it. So there's, it's a little archaeology project.
He was crazy. And
no,
is it going to
crazy?
Is it steam powered?
I think it will have to be steam powered, just because the amount of metal you got to move around.
Holy,
a
small steam engine, a few thousand gears, and a dream.
Yep.
Plan28.org if you want to read about it.
That's the one.
Yeah. Do you have enough money to do it?
We have enough money for the moment. When we come to build it, I suspect we're going to need quite a lot more money just because of the amount of brass we're going to need. But for the moment, it's research projects, and we managed to get a very large grant to do that. So that's happening.
Wow. It's made out of brass.
It's made out of gunmetal, which is an amalgam of a couple of different things. And a lot of iron as well, of course.
And it's probably horrifically noisy when it's running, right?
Well, we don't know. That's a good question. Babbage was actually quite good about trying to keep things quiet, so we'll see. But it's big.
I can't wait. What a great idea. Anyway, great to have you all here. This had a lot of news this week, and I don't know exactly what the big story is. I have to think it's the bid by Comcast to buy Time Warner Cable. Which strikes me as perhaps a tempest in the teapot, since there's no way the Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, or the FCC will approve this, or is there, Om?
I have a sneaking suspicion that this will get approved, because I think all the processes, the anti-monopoly processes we have been broken in this country, and they have been for a while. I think the excuse Comcast is going to make is that since there is no overlap in the territories, it's not really a monopoly. But it doesn't make any sense for the government to approve this, but it will get approved, unfortunately.
Does that serenity carry weight, the fact that they're not in the same market? So if my internet service provider or cable company is Comcast, it's not going to change. If it's Time Warner, it's not going to change. That just the merged company will have more customers.
They're growing larger. We've seen this in mergers in the past. I'm not an expert on monopoly law, but I'm not terribly shocked if this is, like, I don't necessarily want it to pass, but I won't be shocked if they agree. Department of Justice agrees to kind of let this come together. The markets is a good loophole. And in addition, there's so much Comcast lobbying money in Washington right now for a variety of things, net neutrality among them, that I'm not going to be shocked if they don't say too much about it.
The reason I would be, worried about this is not just that they're going to be not in the same markets, but these guys will have a massive influence on how you and I access content on the internet. So if they have such a massive, control over the consumer market, they can actually control the pricing, the per gigabyte bandwidth pricing can come into play. They can do things like charge, companies more money to send traffic on their network. And I think that's the big challenge right now is if you are any future Instagram or any future Netflix has very little, recourse once you have these mega, giants controlling the internet access. And I think that is the thing we should all be worried about. Not that they are not in the same markets. The challenge we have is that the FCC chairman is a cable guy. Yeah. So good luck trying to get anything past him. Or you look at some of the other legislative bodies. They're like pretty highly compromised, and the lobbying machines of cable companies and telcos is pretty amazingly strong. And I think people here in the Valley don't quite understand or don't really pay that much attention to the politics of networks. Like, they are all so obsessed with the here and now of lining their pockets that they don't really realize that these are the guys who are the enemy of innovation in America is the big giant cable and telephony monopolies. And I think I am increasingly worried about what's going to happen in the future.
It's not. It's both cable television and internet, and it's bad in both businesses. Comcast is the number one cable company, 23 million subs. Time Warner Cable number two with 12. That makes them 35 million subscribers. They're the number. Comcast is the number one ISP. Time Warner is the number three ISP. That would give them a total of 31 million households. And I think it's been pretty clear. I don't know about Time Warner, but it's been pretty clear that Comcast doesn't care a whit for net neutrality. And having this kind of clout with content creators will put a terrible burden on content creators. I think there's pretty good evidence, even though it's illegal, that Comcast, for instance, is slowing down Netflix right now. Say again. Sorry.
There's an interesting thing that Recode was reporting, in that Comcast supposedly has a written or a verbal agreement with the FCC to abide by the open internet rules until 2018, despite the fact that the open internet rules are, of course, no more, thanks to Verizon. But there is this problem with Netflix going on, and there are, you know, hints here and there, and between that and the lobbyist money, I'm very concerned about everything that's going down right now.
This is purely anecdotal, but I think everybody who's watching who's on Comcast probably has experienced this. Matt Vukash is a software engineer who wrote a blog post. He says Comcast is definitely throttling Netflix. He uses, and despite the fact that you're right, this is in violation of their existing agreement not to do so. The problem is that Comcast owns its own streaming business, Xfinity StreamPix. So it's a direct competitor to Netflix. So what he did is he tried Comcast over an extended period of time. He was getting terrible Comcast results on his network. He's a student, and so he's at Indiana University, and he tried Netflix just without, just direct connect. He was getting 235 kilobits per second over Comcast. 235 kilobits per second. That means he was at best able to get 320 by 240 video. And it buffered all the time, of course. Then he did something interesting. Instead of getting Netflix directly, he used his university's VPN. Now, normally you wouldn't want to use a VPN for streaming video because the overhead would slow it down. Remember, without the VPN, when the ISP could see what he was doing, 235 kilobits per second. With the VPN, 3,000 kilobits per second. Comcast couldn't see into the encrypted tunnel, so didn't know to block that traffic. And despite the VPN overhead, he was able to get high-quality 720p video consistently over VPN. He says, you know, he contacted Comcast on two separate occasions. They found no problems with his internet. Then they said he'd get a follow-up call from a network engineer. Call never came. I have to say, this is pretty clearly, anybody who's used Comcast to watch Netflix knows it doesn't work consistently. It's often terrible. And that's when Comcast, you know, is just the little old Comcast. Now it's going to be the cable town that owns everything. It can only get worse.
Agreed. And, you know, I think the big thing we should all be thinking about is how can a company which controls the access also controls the content?
Right.
I mean, if they want to be the cable giant, they need to start spinning out everything else they own in the content side of things so that they can be in one business. So this at least gives some power back to the content owners. So if you are a cable company and you are going to dictate the terms, so now they're going to be so big that they can dictate terms to content owners like ESPN and everybody else. They can dictate terms to internet companies like the Netflix of the world. I mean, this is just insane to think that we are dealing with a merger like this. We've been there before, and we are making essentially one more too big to fail kind of a corporation. And the problem is there is nothing as consumers we can do about it, because our whole political system is so compromised. Just look at, you know, how many people come out of FCC and they go and go work for you know, cable companies or telephone companies. And the reason for that is, like, why would they want to risk their own personal future and take any tough decisions when, you know, they know they have a cushy job waiting for them if they don't do anything? Like, they don't have to do anything and they just end up making these big giants winners. And, like, I am increasingly, you know, not, you know, optimistic about the future of commercial internet in this country, because it just is like a two-tier monopoly. We have either the phone companies, right, or you have the cable companies.
It's a duopoly.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can't just blame government, which obviously isn't the most activist in this, but you might also want to blame ourselves. I think that there's a certain amount of fatigue, even among geeks who know this is a bad thing. You know, this week was the, on Tuesday was the day we fight back, except everybody decided not to fight at all. Remember, we were supposed to have a big action on Tuesday against mass surveillance, call your legislator. The good news is 90,000 people did use the website to call their members of Congress. I didn't see a lot on the net about this, though. It seemed like it was awfully quiet.
Do you think it's surprising, though, that not that many people called in about this? This is a pretty complicated technical topic, right? I mean, this is not a simple thing to say, should I be disagreeing with the government about this?
I also feel like, we did SOPA PIPA 2 years ago. Same people. Seemed to be very effective. We actually stopped it, I think, Congress. But I think there's a certain amount of fatigue is set in.
Well, go ahead.
I can tell you that from a Cloudflare's perspective, where I work, I mean, we had a huge number of our customers participating because we made it a one-click thing where you could say, on my website, show the banner. And we've taken a very strong stand on this. So I think people did participate, but you've got to be pretty clued into what the issues are to want to actually call your congressman.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, and you're in the UK, where, of course, the GCHQ is just as bad, if not worse, than the NSA, and is feeding off the same trough of data the NSA is feeding off of.
Well, I think the ironic thing is that whenever I hear Americans talking about this issue, is that you have to have the perspective that you are talking about it in the context of a legal framework. There is actually a legal framework. What came out in some of the Snowden documents is that the legal framework in the UK is much weaker.
There's a long-standing tradition of government spying and so forth.
And also, you know, there are other things going on in the UK, like we have filters on the internet,
right?
Yes. Being pushed by the government.
David Cameron's famous anti-porn filters.
anti-porn filters. And now we've heard today that they want to extend it in some cases for extremist websites, so that you can't see certain sorts of content. So that's a slippery slope.
No kidding. What is extremist? Whoever doesn't agree with David Cameron, I would guess.
I don't think you have to be extreme to disagree with David Cameron.
I think there is somebody who said that democracy is nothing but perception, and that's what it really is.
Yeah.
Getting proven every day, we see that our government spies on us. You know, people actually have very little respect for fellow citizens, and I think the idea that the British people need to be censored on the internet makes no sense to me. It's like, wait, how does that even make any sense? Who is David Cameron to decide what is pornography or what is, you know, unfair language? And I think that is where we start to kind of lose a little bit of grip on society per se. And I think I'm beginning to feel that more and more of this news comes out and more people around us are developing a certain apathy towards the whole thing.
It feels like that.
Yeah. And I think a lot it has to do with the incremental nature with which information is coming out. Like, people are just like reading in tiny bits on the internet. You know, remember that every time we've had big scandals in the past which led to major change, there were like consistent, like big reports which always laid context to the things which were going on and giving people an understanding of how it impacts them. I see much less of that happening, especially in the big media. And I see more of like, let's report on the news. Let's do some, you know, mudslinging on people bringing that news or the information. You know, let's mudsling on the whistleblower rather than just talking about what is the big issue at hand. Are we going to be a different kind of democratic society going forward? How are we going to govern ourselves in this time of change and the internet? So I think instead of focusing on all those things, we are beginning to focus on all the ephemeral here and now things, which have much lesser impact. But, you know, I think as media people, as media entities, we need to take a step back and say, okay, what is the role we do need to play going forward? I think that's a huge challenge I find in on an ongoing basis. Like, I mean, I find really hard to grasp all the changes or all the information that is coming out of the Snowden, you know, files, I guess. And like, I still don't understand, like, how does it impact me, right, the world around me? And I hear a lot of the fireworks around it. I don't hear about the actual problem and what
I think
means.
Maybe we can, it's harder for us to grasp the privacy implications, but this Comcast Time Warner merger impacts the free and open internet. And a lot of this impacts the free and open internet. And can we not, as geeks, at least stand for that, to stand to protect the internet? It seems so important. Tim Wu wrote a great book about this called The Master Switch, in which he said it's the nature of open networks to become closed. He starts in the book, he starts with talking about the long-distance telephone system, but he uses the cable and broadcast TV industries, the Hollywood entertainment industry, and ultimately the internet as examples of this. In other words, he would say probably, oh, this is exactly what you'd expect. The incumbent, you know, you have a free and open internet until there's some real money to be made. Then the big incumbents come in and say, yeah, we'll take it from here. Is that what's happening?
I mean, that's what you really think, you know, is happening. It's not just that. I think the challenge is that we don't have anyone actually putting any oversight on these guys.
No.
Right? That's the bigger problem. Just like, you know, maybe some of us have no problems with whatever is coming out from what NSA is doing, but where is the oversight? What is the clarity on oversight? Why do we have a government if we don't know what it's doing? Why do we have FCC or FTC when we know that they're not going to do anything in favor of the citizens and look out for the citizens' interest? And I think that is a bigger problem, more not that these big companies are trying to become bigger. I mean, that's the nature of corporations. We need to find our ways to control and put, like, you know, some kind of, you know, legislative controls on these companies. Not like, otherwise they run amok. Like, it's like, I'm all for, like, you know, full-on capitalism, but we still need some kind of rules and regulations to keep these guys in check. I mean, I think, and there is nobody who's going to do that. Like, that is become more and more obvious in the last 3 to 4 years.
The most depressing thing is to see Brian Roberts, the chairman of Comcast and NBC Universal, golfing with President Obama, who's a big supporter for Obama. And then you have to think, God, he's not going to, there's no way anybody's going to say no to this guy. It's, you know, just, it's House of Cards, baby.
That's right, it is.
You know, I was watching that for the first time this weekend because I was sick and I haven't gotten a chance to. So I'm like, you know what? I have a weekend.
You have to watch it.
And of course, the second season just came out.
You watched all of the first season, right? First?
Yeah, okay. I just did that yesterday. I watched episodes 1 through 13 and just kind of mainlined it. And now I'm on the second episode of the second season. And comparing this, granted, House of Cards is kind of our alternate darkest timeline version of the right. House of Representatives and the US
I don't think
government.
The vice president's a murderer.
Probably not.
I don't think Joe Biden's killing people, but
he's too cute to kill people, let's be honest. But there are some similarities. I mean, yeah. there are politicians out there who are in certain companies' pockets. Yeah. Like it is unfortunately what business has become down there. And
how were you watching Netflix? Was the speed pretty good?
Actually, it wasn't too bad.
Okay,
but I started watching House of Cards last night around 6 p.m. So I feel like it was like maybe off peak hours. But then again, House of Cards season 2 just came out, so maybe everybody's watching
it's all
it.
All peak hours now, baby.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Comcast feels guilty because they wouldn't let me watch the Olympics this week.
Are you a Comcast customer?
I am, unfortunately. I used to be a Charter customer, and they're not that much better. But I got into a tiff with them this week because I have a TV internet combo, and the TV allows me for basic cable and HBO because it was a special deal, so I could, you know, watch Game of Thrones legally. But apparently, paying that much money per month and getting that cable does not include me watching the Olympics, despite them advertising being like, if you're a Comcast subscriber, you have to be on the, if I paid $60 a month more, I could be on that tier. But apparently NBC Sports is the second tier up. So you can't just pay for television. You have to pay for
And you don't have extra. It on demand? It's not in your on demand?
It is in my on demand. That's the hilarious thing, is it shows up as like, watch the, you know, short program for the pairs skaters. And then when you tap on it, it's like, I'm sorry, you don't have this. You don't have this subscription. It's like,
you're not paying $100 a month yet. Got to keep working on it. Get that bill up. But Om, you wrote right after this merger that it isn't about cable television. It's about broadband.
Yeah, they don't really talk about the broadband part, mostly because they don't disclose their margins on that business. They don't disclose a lot of stuff on that business, mostly because it's very profitable to them. I think
that's interesting.
And you know, I think there is, I mean, I wrote a post about this a little while ago, which compared like how much, you know, how much frequency they need or how many channels they need to pump out broadband, and like how much money they have to spend to get content for those networks. So compared to that, the broadband networks are just more profitable.
That's encouraging in a way. I remember talking to Cablevision many years ago, and they said, we just can't make internet work. We have to sell, you know, from a business point of view, we have to sell premium content over cable, HBO and the Olympics over cable, because the economics of internet are not good. But you say that's not the case. In fact, the internet business is the fastest growing, has the highest gross margins. And of course, you don't have to negotiate with anybody for programming. Does this mean that Comcast or a unified Comcast Time Warner Cable would head toward being an internet company, particularly?
They already are an internet company. Look at, you know, they have 90% plus margins on their voice business. Well, that voice business runs on the internet, right?
Like, right.
On the internet part of their network, right? So it's like they are making so much more money from these things, and they will continue to make more money. I mean, what would you rather give up, the cable connection or the internet connection? I can guarantee you there is at least in, you know, people who are like 20 to 40 years old, they would rather give up their cable connection than they give up their internet connection.
Well, especially since I can watch House of Cards on internet and I can't watch it on cable.
Right. And I think that's where it's at. Like the money in the future is going to come from the internet connection. I mean, think about it this way. That your, whether it's your Nest or Hue or any of those Internet of Things you might have in your home, your iPads, everything needs internet connection. So that's a business they will control, and they will increase the prices on that just the way they have increased prices on cable, because there is no competition. And don't be surprised if you're paying almost $150 a month for your internet connection in 2 years or 3 years.
You know what? I'd pay that if it were good, fast, and reliable.
I mean, I pay $40 a month.
Yeah, but we've heard you've got this apartment and you got the thing, and you're in a unique situation.
No, I made this my unique situation. I will not move into any building which I have to use Comcast or Time Warner or Verizon. I am all for supporting independent ISPs.
I wonder, you know, we have a great independent ISP up here, SonicNet, and they, you know, consistently come out on top in terms of fighting the government when the government asks for information, of providing better service. They're growing fast. I wonder if this isn't an opportunity for a company like that. The problem is they don't have access to the cable copper. They only have access to the DSL copper. The FCC allows the cable companies to say, no, nobody else can use this. We paid for it. It's ours. While they require, I'm not sure why, the phone company to open up their network center to other competitors.
It has to do with how they're regulated. I did some research into this because I ended up doing a comic a while back for Common Cause. It's a little bit crazy, and it's really frustrating because it comes down to who owns all of the wires. And if you're a smaller company, you have to rent, either forcibly try and rent from the bigger companies,
right,
or be a satellite company, which requires owning a satellite or renting time off a satellite, which is just crazy.
So we're stuck with this duopoly that the government created.
Actually, there is another way of thinking about it. You talked about SonicNet. The reason SonicNet delivers what it does, it's not just because it can, get access to the phone company's phone lines. It also is building its own network, and it is doing, things in a much smaller fashion, which allows the company to expand in a more, thoughtful sort of a way. I think building a nationwide network is very expensive, but you can build out networks in small cities or small neighborhoods, just like your ISP, which is Sonic.net, has done, or my ISP, which is Webpast, has done. Is they've gone after very specific niche markets and then use that to expand their base and become a business. And I think the only way to build out independent ISPs is through having a very small and focused approach rather than having a national approach to building out an ISP. And the technologies are pretty, the equipment we need and all those things we need to make a network is not that expensive anymore. I think the cost...
Is Google Fiber a viable option, for instance?
If Google wants it to be, it could be a really good viable option.
But it's got to be... I know when Verizon was doing Fios, they said it cost us $5,000 per customer to get fiber to them on average. That's you got to pay $100 a month for a long time to make up $5,000.
Right. But that was also 8 years ago.
Right.
Right. So the great thing about technology is everything does get cheaper.
Yeah.
I mean, the Google network is much cheaper compared to those guys because they went into one small city, set it up. Now, if they went to like maybe 20 cities like that every year, maybe, somewhere between $5 to $20 billion. Right. I mean, and if they can turn those networks into networks for, like, which ensure video advertising to their products, I mean, they can pay off much faster. I think there is clearly, like, if there is any hope of competition on a national level, it would be Google. On a regional and a small city level, I think a lot more people should be thinking about ISPs. I told the guys from Sonic.net that they should open source their network architecture plans so that other people can copy them and roll them out, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what we need to be thinking about. How do we actually overcome these guys? Maybe it's time to think about an alternate independent internet, which is not controlled by, phone companies.
I think that's what you get. If you get in some ways, I want a Comcast, Time Warner Cable merger. In some ways, I want the big companies to screw it up. Block Skype, block Netflix, ruin the internet. Please do, because maybe then that will stimulate geeks to do something different, to create a new internet that is not, run by these companies.
Well, in theory, it'll create outrage from your average user, too.
Yeah.
Because most people don't care, but if suddenly, oh, wait, I can't get my Netflix? Why can't I watch the new season of Orange is the New Black? What's going on? Then they get angry and call their congressman. When they talk about...
Is it viable, though? Is it? I mean, that's the question. Rights of way, the cost of the trenching, the cost of the fiber. Is it possible to create... That's what they did in your building, right? They bought wholesale internet and then created, in effect, a building-wide internet service provider, right?
That's correct. So they are in all the high rises in south of Market in San Francisco.
I mean, it works in an urban area better, of course, because there's a higher density of population. There's more chance to make
money. But think about it this way. I think Lee Gallagher wrote a book called The End of Suburbs, in which she talks about how we are all moving back to the city. Cities are becoming bigger and bigger, which is actually not such a bad thing. It allows alternate internet access models to emerge, right? Because you have a much more dense population in an urban area. You can actually build out an alternate internet right there.
Right.
And I think there is something needs to happen, clearly. I think we cannot expect our government to do anything for us. We don't expect FCC to do anything for us. So I think it is time for geese to stop thinking about, you know, apps which let us share secrets and, you know, work on things which allow us to build out a network, which is truly a network for use and not like controlled by this big giant corporation. I think it's time for people to think about it in a more serious manner.
We talk about the worst.
How is the Google Fiber thing a good thing? I think that's kind of a scary thing. Now, not only has Google got my email, my calendar, every single other thing, they actually have the fiber coming into my home. I mean, there would be a terrifying prospect you'd have Google. I find them more scary than Comcast.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like Google's a lot more transparent. I mean, any internet service provider has access to everything you do on the internet. So the only question is which one you would trust more. And you're saying, well, you obviously, you live in England. You don't know anything about how bad Comcast is. That's the problem.
Well, I did live in the U.S. for a long time, and I do remember that internet access absolutely sucked absolutely everywhere. And that, interestingly enough, coming back to Europe, where everything's heavily regulated, I have a 20 megabit internet connection that costs me $25 a month, and I have a choice of companies.
Comcast has consistently been voted the worst company in America and by consumerists, although this year Electronic Arts beat them. Not a surprise. But that's another story.
That's Sim City, dude.
Yeah, The Sims and everything else. Believe me, if you've ever...
just Sim City.
Not just Sim City. No. It's much worse than that.
We've had a long Dungeon Keeper problems.
I'll give you Dungeon Keeper, which just came out on the iPad, and you cannot play it. It's a free game, except that you can't play it, really, unless you give them lots of money for gems.
I had to buy a Windows machine to play Sim City.
Oh, you got robbed. Robbed.
So good.
But you're right. SimCity was one of the reasons EA was named the worst company in America this year. The other thing, Comcast consistently rates below the IRS on the customer satisfaction index, below our national tax collection agency. So believe me, I don't want Comcast to get any bigger. But I think the problem is for most of us, I'm a Comcast customer. Actually, we're Comcast customers here and at home, and we don't have much choice. They're just in most areas of the country, you have two choices. The phone company. Well, you have three if you include satellite. The phone company, the cable company, or a satellite. And it's getting worse all the time. Oh, one more thing, and then we'll go to a break. Comcast customers, you might want to change your password. Turns out Comcast has been hacked, and they're downplaying it. Null Crew hacked into at least 34 of Comcast servers. Published a list of the mail servers and a link to the root file with the vulnerability it used. This vulnerability has been around for a long time. Comcast has known about it for a long time. However, they never patched the vulnerability. Well, many others did, but not Comcast. And so Violet Blue, writing on the Zero Day blog on ZDNet, says, as soon as I saw this, I did change my Comcast password. Change your password. While Comcast isn't talking about it, they're using the Snapchat method of cover up. It probably would be a good idea if you value your email to change your password.
I feel bad for anybody who's using a Comcast email.
that's what I was going to say. Who uses their ISP email address?
Well, I use Gmail, but I do have. If you have a Comcast account, you have a Comcast email bag, and it may be that, in fact, there's stuff in there Comcast sends you and so forth.
They send you pretty detailed information. Yeah. They will send you, I think, billing statements and things like that if you're not careful.
Yeah. Might want to change that password. Serenity Caldwell is here from MacWorld.com. Always great to have you.
Always great to be here.
Buried in the snow in beautiful Baston. Om Malik from San Francisco, gigaom.com. And don't forget om.co, his personal blog. I go there every week to see what he's reading. And his reading list is very, very juicy. This is a beautiful blog. Om.co. Omco. And from Great Britain, John Graham Cumming, programmer, Cloudflare. I forgot to mention Cloudflare.
Here's the Cloudflare t-shirt.
What do you do at Cloudflare?
Well, I help us build a better internet. That's what we're trying to do.
Oh, so good I'm man. Cloudflare is used by a lot of companies to protect against DDoS attacks, right?
I mean, that's one thing. Yeah. That's one thing. Yeah. Yep. Yep. There's many others. I mean, we are all about building a better experience for people on the internet by building out a better internet. And so that starts with the websites. And part of that is DDoS protection, and part of it is making them faster, and part of it is making them available all around the world.
Good. Are you? Is it a CDN as well as a bandwidth provider?
Yes, that's part of what we do as a CDN. So we do all the sort of caching type things. But ultimately, people who use Cloudflare services, their whole website is on us, not just the static assets.
Got it. What's that floppy disk behind you there? Over your right shoulder?
Well, obviously, this one over here, that's an 8-inch floppy.
Yes, I recognized it.
Yeah, that's actually just some code I have lying around. It's some assembly language code for a Z80 processor.
Ah, did you write
it? Yeah, that's some code I wrote in 85, I think.
I should frame my assembly language code, put it on the wall, too.
Well, I just have it because it reminds me that, you know, disks existed, first of all, and they were that big, so...
Remember when it all started. Yep.
Yes, yep. I do. Yep.
John has a great Tumblelog. We'll talk about it later on in the show, where he keeps code snippets that you might see in a movie. It's an interesting story. I want to talk about that a little later on. But for now, I want to talk a little bit about another company that helps put you online, Hover.com, the domain registrar that makes it clean, simple, and easy. We love Hover. All my domain names are registered with Hover. When you have a great idea, you want to get a domain name for it. You want something good, catchy, memorable. Go to Hover.com and get it. It makes it very easy. They do all the top-level domains, .com, .net, .org, .tv, .pro, .mobi, .biz, .io, all the popular country codes, .ca, .asia, .us, .uk. Actually, .tv is a country code. I have twit.tv through hover.com. It makes it very easy, too. You know, a lot of these registrars, you say, I want a domain name, and then you have to click 1,000 times. Oh, what are those new ones? Some new domain TLDs. Dot camera? Really? Dot equipment? Dot estate? Dot gallery? Dot graphics? Dot lighting? Dot photography? Wow. ICANN's gone cuckoo. That's cool. These are all available at Hover right now. When you buy a domain name, you don't have 50 clicks. They make it very straightforward. They know, for instance, that you'll want Whois privacy so that it's included in the price. Boom, jump. Subdomains, URL forwarding as well. The domain registration is easy, but so is domain management. Couldn't be simpler on Hover.com. I've found it completely just clean, simple, and beautiful. And great support. Should you run into a problem, you get business hour phone support Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern time. Guaranteed to speak to a live person who's empowered to help you to get the job done. They're eager to help. And, of course, help at hover.com is there as well. I've got 22 domain names registered at Hover. My kids, the TV. I got my kids' domain names right away when they were born. They don't want them. But someday. I registered AbbyLaporte.com through 2020. I figured if she doesn't want it by then, I probably should just give it up. But they've got, you know, they got it through January 2020. It's kind of fun to see this. These are some of the older sites. When I got my ham license, I got my ham call sign at Hover. You're going to love it. And we've got a special deal for you. Hover.com/twit2. To register your domain name and for 10% off your first purchase, use the offer code TWIT2. We're in February, so you get it. Hover.com/TWIT2. Use the offer code TWIT2 to save 10% off your first domain. They also have Google Apps, which is nice because they support it. So you can get Google Apps for the same price you get from Google, but with support from Hover.com. So that's really handy. You can add email to any of your domains as well. Very sweet. Hover.com/TWIT2. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. I think we've covered the Time Warner thing sufficiently. We're just going to have to watch with interest. I'm not sure what the timeline is. Am I right, Omen, saying that it is the FTC, FCC, and the DOJ? I mean, DOJ is on antitrust. It's going to go through that pretty sweet. Easy. Maybe the FCC will have something to say about it.
I think we should have something out in like 3 to 6 months. Though okay. I wouldn't be surprised if Charter Communications makes a hostile bid for...
Ah, interesting.
Because they were interested in buying them, and we haven't heard anything
right
from them just yet. So my view is that we shouldn't rule that out just yet.
Interesting. Because Charter was looking at Cox Cable. See, this is very much like the mobile phone market, where you get this sudden, whoosh, it goes from, you know, six companies down to two in a matter of time. We saw it happen with radio. They killed radio, thanks to the lack of oversight from the FCC. Now it's going to kill cable and the internet. Google's acquisition of Nest is final. They now own the thermostat company. I don't know what they're going to do with it.
There's nothing creepy about that either, about your thermostat.
You don't. Are you afraid? Or what are you afraid of? What do you think Google's going to do with all that information about you?
I think that once you have that much information, the temptation will be to do all sorts of amazing things with it. And if Google has my ISP and my email and knows when I'm home and what the temperature is, I mean, you know.
So what?
I just think it's too much power in one company. You know, it's centralization of way too much information.
Yeah, but I wouldn't
disagree with John. I think people underestimate the clout Google has, both in Washington and increasingly on our internet lives. And I won't be surprised, you know, they have more control on it. I think, again, they are one of those companies which is going unchecked because they have managed to, you know, circumvent the whole political system really well. They've found the right lobbyists, right? You know, they've done everything right to ensure that they are in business for a very, very long time. And they have basically taken care of all the right politicians to keep moving. I mean, you know, Eric Schmidt has dinner with President Obama. I think that just is what we need to really know, right? The picture says more than any amount of headlines would say.
But what are they? I understand that, but to me, it just means a better Google now. You know, hey, I see you're not home right now. You know, your thermostat's at 84. You want to turn that down? Do you anticipate some horrendous result? Like what they're going to say? Oh, Leo's home. Telemarketers, descend on him. Is that what you anticipate? I don't.
I mean, why not? Why not? When I have you called up as, yo, he's home, he'll definitely answer the phone. And
they're not going to do that. I would immediately.
Why not?
Because then you'll disconnect all your stuff. You'll go, I don't like it.
They've got a balance between, you know, Google is collecting all of this information, but they can't outwardly just be like, oh, we're going to sell everything publicly and you're going to immediately know about it. Because, yeah, then people would stop. I mean, there are definitely questionable practices going on at Google with the data that they're collecting right now. And it's true if you're using a free service that you are what is being sold.
Targeted ads do not bother me. I think that's a better ad than a non-targeted ad.
I mean, it's annoying to, like, visit a page for a baking instrument and then see that baking instrument on 30 different web pages that you visit, because it's a little freaky, but still, I mean, at least they know what you like. I just don't see Google using that, going into the, you know, the thermostat space and using that as a tool. Oh, this person only likes it really warm. Maybe we should market sweaters to them.
But that doesn't, so I see sweater ads. I'm going to see ads anyway, right? Wouldn't you rather see an ad for something you'd like than something you don't care about? What's wrong with that?
No, there's nothing wrong with that as you describe it. What I find creepy is the idea that Google will know when I'm home, will know how many times I burn the toast because I set the smoke alarm off.
Your neighbor knows that.
Yes, but my neighbor doesn't aggregate everything else about me and then use it to sell me something. The neighbor comes around and says, will you shut the smoke alarm off? It's woken me up. I think it's natural for any large organization to just to get larger and larger and larger. And there's way too much, way too much information there. And, why the hell did Google buy a thermostat company for $3 billion? And also at the same time buy a lot of robotics companies? No, I'm sorry. It's too much.
Okay, I understand the creepy factor, but that's a visceral reaction to something. I'm just trying to find a rational reason why. I mean, I understand emotionally why this is disturbing, but I'm just trying to think of what the rational outcome of this that is so horrific is. And is it the case that what we do is we say? I mean, certainly the case we. I guess it is what we do with people. If as soon as a company gets too big, we want to cut it down to size?
Well, it's nerve-wracking a little bit when everybody is... Google in particular has shown that it is not interested in just one market. It wants to control multiple markets. And I think that might be some of the pushback that they're receiving on Nest. Because by snapping up the Nest team, not only are they getting Nest, which is a pretty cool device, and the Nest Protect, the smoke detector, but they're getting the entire Nest hardware team. And I think that's the real coup for Apple here, or Apple for Google here, is that they're getting ex-Apple people. They're getting really talented hardware engineers, which may signal the fact that Google's going to make a play for the hardware space beyond, the Q, which is a terrible failure, and the Google TVs, which were partners, and, the Android phones, which have been partners. Google let go of Motorola to buy Nest. There's some interesting things there. They're branching out, which I think scares a lot of people.
I think the key thing to think about Google and Nest acquisition is that what do they do, right? Like every company, in order to grow, has to find a new revenue stream, right? So they are...
Especially if they're a public company, there's huge pressure.
Right. And they only have one revenue stream right now, which is advertising. And even on the Android side of things, it still drives advertising. It doesn't drive... any other kind of revenue. So they need to find new revenue schemes. And I think Google Fiber is one of them as an option for them to drive business. And similarly, it won't surprise me if Tony Fadell heads up Android in two years from now.
That would make sense, actually.
Right? I mean, he is the best equipped person to run that group. He's the best equipped person to help them expand into different hardware groups. Now think about it this way, that Google understands the internet, being native internet company. It understands data better than most people. What it doesn't understand is a very human software interface, right? And I think something like that comes from a guy like Tony and his team, and it starts to all add up. And I think it's something, again, we will understand about this in 2 years from now, right? What are they going to do with the robots? I don't know, but it is the prospect of what they're going to do with robots and, self-driven cars and all those things. It just is scary, mostly because, we don't know how this company is going to behave in the future. So far, they have a mixed record when it comes to dealing with human beings, right? So it just is a little bit, the company is beginning to make us queasy because it's becoming increasingly more, its tentacles are spreading wider and wider, and it's going unchecked. There is no competition for Google, if you really think about it.
No.
They have,
But you know how we stop it? We stop using Google. If people are really worried, stop using Google, stop buying Nests. I mean, nobody's making you do this. Isn't that the best way to limit Google's growth? Just stop using it. Are you going to use Microsoft Bing from now on?
Well, me, I use DuckGoGo.
DuckDuckGoGo.
I tried to use that. I did an experiment using DuckDuckGo for quite a long time, actually 6 months. And
Google works.
Yeah, unfortunately, Google works extremely well for search. I don't have any problem with Google and search. I have a problem with my smoke alarm knowing where when I'm in the house. And, you know, the moment that thing starts talking to me and advertising to me,
Who's the worst? Who's more a threat on the internet, Google or Comcast?
I dislike Comcast far more than Google.
Yeah, I kind of like Google. Maybe I won't always like them.
Yeah, I have my beefs with Google, but at the end of the day, at least I can, you know, I feel like Google is more of a responsive company than Comcast is. Comcast is very much stuck in its ways, which I suppose on one end could mean that it's the less dangerous of the two because it's going to be a dinosaur.
They're old and dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. Google is us. Google is our people.
But Google isn't at all responsive, is it? I mean, have you ever tried to get phone support from Google? I mean, you can't get them on the phone, right? Comcast, you can get somebody on the phone.
Yeah, I don't think you want to get the people on the phone that you get on the phone when you get Comcast on the phone. That is not a good experience at all.
I just would say one thing, Leo. Google is not us. Google is them. Believe it or not.
But they're kind of like us, aren't they?
No, they're not.
No.
Oh, really? Okay. Why aren't they not like us, though?
Ooh, I mean, that's just is a long conversation.
Much longer. You think Larry and Sergey aren't just geeks who had a hit and they took their money and they said, hey, this is great. We got a ton of money. Let's go buy a Zeppelin hangar, a couple of jets, and some autonomous vehicles, maybe some robots. That's what I would do if I had their money.
I would buy a jet and go around the world and just hang out.
Oh, see, that's why you'll never be a great success, you see.
I'm okay being moderate.
You got to work harder, Ohm. No, it
doesn't matter.
Travel around the world. What are you, nuts?
Yeah, I'm old.
But seriously, don't I feel, okay, maybe this is just me, but I think Serenity agrees with me. They feel like they're more our part of our culture than Comcast does. Yeah,
I think they've done a fantastic job of marketing that idea that they're not evil.
I don't know if I'd necessarily, again, the don't be evil slogan is funny, and I don't necessarily think that Google has become evil, but I'd put them closer to the good part of the spectrum than I'd put Comcast. Comcast deliberately manipulates and, you know, and plays with its users. Google manipulates its users, but is usually pretty upfront about it. Or it's like, yeah, we're taking your data and using it for ads. If you don't like it, you can go somewhere else. Comcast is like, we're going to pretend that you can get this stuff and do this, and instead we're going to, you know, under the surface, we're going to limit your speeds and prevent you from getting certain things. You know,
Google has a dashboard where they tell you exactly what they know about you. They give you control of it. You can download every bit of data that you've ever put on Google with their data takeout. I just feel like this is a company that understands our concerns and does what they can to give us control of it. I mean, maybe 5 years from now I will deeply regret it, but it feels to me like this is providing a service. I like what I get from Google, and I don't feel like there's a threat to me from Google.
No, I think what I'm saying is, and I think John is saying is, we need to have a healthy skepticism of them.
Yes.
We cannot believe that they are doing this through the good of their heart, right?
Nobody, no, they're doing exactly. It to make money. They're a capitalist business.
Right, and when somebody says, don't be evil, there is a chance you have a guilty conscience. That's why you came up with that letter.
I think that comes from them saying, we want to be a successful corporation, a business, but we want to do it not being evil. And in the modern world, that's the right way to do it because evil will out. The internet lets everybody know what's going on. And a company like Comcast people are going to know they're evil. So we better not be evil. That's the way to success in the modern world. I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, and also, you know, remember the tagline of Fox Business is fair and balanced.
Yeah, well, that's true.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Do you think that their success is corrupting them?
Power corrupts everyone, my friend. What are you talking about? Look at you yourself.
I am evil. and proud of it.
Just made sure that we were all on screen so that you don't have to meet with us in person.
And anybody who has a chair like this is definitely evil. Hello, Mr. Malik. I've invited you here for one reason and one reason only. Do you think...
Where is the bald cat?
I need a bald cat. Shave my dog and bring him to me. Google Watch, we're getting a lot of buzz about that. Everybody's been talking about the Apple Watch. Serenity, you cover this. Do you believe Apple really is doing a watch this year?
I believe Apple's doing some kind of wearable technology and that it will likely at least preview at WWDC this year. Whether or not that's a watch, whether or not that's a fitness tracker, whether it's a hybrid of something, I think is too early to say.
Yeah.
There's lots of rumor and lots of speculation out there. I do think Apple will try and make a move into that market somewhere this year. I think waiting another year, unless they have something go catastrophically wrong with their other product lines, it seems like it's going to be too long of a time.
Strikes me that the Google Glass has kind of lost steam.
It's kind of a niche product to begin with. Most of the interactions that the general public has had with it is either gross fascination, arrest records, or the word I'm looking for I probably can't say on internet television. People who aren't very nice wearing it.
You mean naked people?
or people who just have an attitude problem about, oh, I'm a Google Glass explorer.
Oh, glass holes. Heard of me. That's the word.
Yes, glass holes. Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah.
And I knew there was a more politically correct term.
Glass holes is the right word.
Yeah, I was talking with my colleague, Dan Morin. He was going to a conference this weekend, and I guess he ran into a guy wearing a Google Glass, and someone was asked, like, is that Google Glass? And the guy looks at him and glares at him. He's like, what else do you think it would be?
You fool. Peon, do you not recognize?
The explorers are not really giving them a very good reputation, shall
I
we
confess,
say. And still buggy.
When I see somebody wearing Google Glass, I really want to punch him.
Meanwhile,
I agree.
Yeah, like Scoble. People come here. Is anybody wearing glass here? People come here a lot wearing glass. So I've kind of gotten used to it. But I do have to resist the urge to just slug them in the glasses. I wouldn't wear the watch. I don't know why. Lots of people wear Pebble watches. That doesn't bother me.
Well, the watch doesn't have a camera. And it's not on your face. You know, if you're going to be filming from a watch, assume, say, Apple makes a mythical iWatch or something like that, and they put a camera on it so you can FaceTime. If you're going to be FaceTiming, either you have to hold it up this way so it's going directly at you selfie-wise.
Yes, and your arm will get tired like Ohm's is.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Oh, gosh. Or you're holding it out, in which case it's very visible. With Google Glass, I mean, yes, Google made a big deal of like, oh, yeah, we're not going to let apps automatically record you. But if you have something in front of your eye, A, you don't know if that person's paying attention to you or not because they, you know, have the vacant
glasses. They keep looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, are you paying attention? Yeah, exactly. It's the I'm looking at my phone while talking to you at the dinner table thing, only you can't tell the social cue.
Right.
So, like, that kind of stuff makes me mad. Having a watch is about as bad as a cell phone.
Yes.
Maybe a little bit more convenient, but.
Yes. Yeah. All right.
That was awkward silence.
No, I'm just thinking about. The problem is everybody I know who has glass doesn't wear it anymore. They just got tired of it. And I had a Pebble watch. I got tired of it. Don't you just get. I mean, I carry my smartphone around because it does. It's pragmatic. It does the job. Does everything I need it to do. It's in my pocket. That's fine. I don't want to wear three different things.
It's too heavy. Too many things to charge.
Yeah. Nobody wears wristwatches anymore, except for you, sir. I'm not sure why you're wearing a wristwatch.
Nope. I wear a wristwatch.
That's
there's a certain class.
Okay, what do you wear, though, Om? Is it jewelry or is it a Timex?
It's not Timex, Jesus Christ.
It's jewelry. All right, that's different. That's jewelry.
It's not. It tells me time. It makes me feel good.
Yeah, it's jewelry. We're going to take. And by the way, if an Apple Watch comes out, it better be jewelry. It better look good. Because, you know, I don't want to look like I'm wearing a Casio on my wrist, right?
Can you see Joni Ive letting an iWatch out of the lab?
Exactly.
If it didn't look good. Even the pebble, the new pebble, the steel, it looks better, but it's still, you know, I have tiny little wrists. If that pebble is going to take up this much of my wrist, I need something that's actually going to look like I should be wearing it and not like I'm wearing a weird prototype, you know, 1980s cell phone.
Exactly. It's like it needs a stylus. No woman or tiny man would ever wear it. We're going to take a... That's a terrible thing to say. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with more. John Graham Cumming is here from the UK. Great to have you, John. Miss Serenity Caldwell of the Tiny Wrists. Setern on Twitter. S-E-T-T-E-R-N, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And from Macworld.com. And, of course, O'Malik, who is wearing a fine wrist. Come on, show us your wristwatch.
No.
I know it's something like, okay, so Ohm would never wear a Rolex because that's so obvious, but he's wearing something that is equally expensive but subtle, I would guess. That's just my guess.
It's not very expensive.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to share the name. It's a German watch company.
I love watches. I am not criticizing you.
My watch company is a brand called Nomos.
Okay.
It's a great independent small company. But
I'm Googling it now. I want one.
Okay.
It's the watch that Ohm wears.
Which one I wear, though.
Ooh, these are pretty. Nomos Glashut.
Very Bauhaus. And
yeah, very pretty.
It was my gift to myself when I turned 40.
See, that's nice. And you can hand it down, and it's an heirloom.
I don't know about that.
These are beautiful. Anyway, that's enough for that.
Those watches?
Aren't they gorgeous? I love them.
Those are very pretty.
Yeah. This is what Apple's competing against, frankly. They're going to have something that looks this good. And Google, too. But you know Google will make an ugly one. You know Google will look like a geek watch. Our show
maybe
today
brought... Tony Fidel has otherwise.
Ah, but maybe Tony can save it. You're right. Tony was in charge of iPod when Apple first did the iPod. And, of course, Nest is beautiful. Smoke detector looks like a smoke detector, but I guess it has to. Our show today brought to you by Audible.com, a great place to go. 150,000 audio books, classics. I guess you can pre-order Influx. I'm excited. The new Daniel Suarez novel's coming out. I just finished it. Wonderful. Highly recommend. It won't be out till February 20th, but you could pre-order now and get it right away. And I'm going to tell you how you can get it and another book absolutely free. Michio Kaku's newest, The Future of the Mind, The Scientific Quest to Understand, Enhance, and Empower the Mind. That's coming out in just a few days. There's great stuff at Audible. What's nice about Audible now is I think the publishers finally understand that we love audiobooks. We love them unabridged. We want to hear every word. We want them read not by some stiff, but somebody who can really bring it to life, like Michael C. Hall doing Breakfast at Tiffany's. Now that's got to sound good. He's, of course, Dexter. That's going to give a new slant to Holly Golightly. I am a big fan. They get the best actors, the best readers, reading the best material. You're going to love it, and I want you to try it right now. If you go to audible.com/twit2, you'll be eligible to sign up for the Platinum account. That'll give you 2 credits. That means 2 books could be yours. You've got 30 days to listen. You can cancel at any time. The book is yours to keep. Here's Leander Connie's great new book about Johnny Ive. We had Leander on the show. Really great. Simon Vance narrates it in his great poncy British accent. The genius behind Apple's greatest products. This is another great one. I think Brian Brushwood turned me onto this. Masters of Doom, How 2 Guys Created an Empire and Transformed Pop Culture. Will Wheaton reads that one. If you go to audible.com/twit2, you'll be signing up for the Platinum Plan. 30 days. You cancel any time in the first 30 days. You'll pay nothing, but the book is yours to keep. You also get the daily digest of either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal as part of the subscription. Really, really a great place to go. Try it today. audible.com/twit2. The hardest thing is picking those 2 books, but pick well. Oh, is this new? The Memoirs of Sherlock Holmes, read by Simon Preble. He is a great narrator. What happens after a while with Audibles, you start following the narrators, and you say, what else did he read? because you like the reading so well. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them for their support. The best code snippet on screen that I saw in your Tumble log was actually Elementary, from the TV show Elementary, John Graham Cumming.
What was it? What was that one?
I'm trying to remember. So this, what is the name of the Tumble log? Source code?
It's moviecode.tumblr.com.
Movie code. That's right. The idea is, how did you stumble on this? Did you notice some code on a screen?
Yeah. So I watched the film Elysium at Christmas, and there's some code in it, and it's Intel x86 assembly language. And I was like, oh, I know that. And so I tried to figure out where it came from, and it came from an Intel manual. And I tweeted it just as sort of a joke, and so many people retweeted it or replied with things that I said, okay, you know what? I'll just make a Tumblr and stick it up there. And then I actually only discovered 3 or 4 of the things that are on there. The rest of them are people have submitted them.
There's a lot of code in the movies, and it turns out that there's a great variety in the code in movies. Some of it is just cribbed from a website. Like they looked at the source of a website and pasted it in.
Yep.
And then some of it's like good.
Well, that particular one you got there from Grey's Anatomy is complete and utter nonsense. So that's a really, really, really simple example in Java. And apparently it does something amazing with MRIs.
That's what I love. The people who do these, some of them are very sophisticated, but things happen. For instance, they may think that that screen is going to be in the distance in the background, and suddenly it's front and center in the movie or the TV show. And so, for instance, here's Iron Man 2, Mickey Rourke, remote controlling a war machine by writing an HTML doc type.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that was going to work.
Apparently the robot understands HTML5. That's pretty exciting. But then you see Nmap, the hacker tool, used not only in Elysium, but The Matrix and other movies to do actual hacking. So sometimes it's very accurate.
Yeah, sometimes it's accurate, and sometimes it's utter nonsense, and sometimes it's hilarious. It just depends on, I think, whether the director really cared about it or not.
Right. The funniest one is in a documentary film to encourage people to code.
Oh, yes, in Spain, where it looks like they just banged on the keyboard. And it literally is like, you're learning to code, and it's just random.
But I'm trying to remember what the Elementary screen was, because it was the one that I thought, boy, this is somebody knows a little bit about computers. Yeah, this is the Spanish Ministry of Education, Culture, and Sports video encouraging people to become programmers. And it's just what you'd get if you actually fell face down on the keyboard, passed out drunk. Yeah.
So that actually is how programming is done.
Just in case you were wondering.
Everything at Cloudflare was written just by banging on the keyboard.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently using jQuery will help you guide missiles in the series Strike Back.
jQuery comes up quite often as it's obviously much more powerful than you realize. You can start a war with it or defend against asteroids or other things.
So many things you can do. And yet here's Big Bang Theory with actual whiteboard code that is iOS app code.
Yeah. I mean, that's not that surprising. They do tend to have a lot of little things in Big Bang Theory which are accurate. So the code is good.
I wish I could find this one from Elementary. It just struck me, and I can't remember what it was. But anyway, great site, moviecode.tumblr.com. And if you've got a screenshot of some code on a TV or a movie, you might want to share it. Oh, here it is. This is cool. They used an obscure language I'd never even heard of it called Malbolge.
Absolutely.
And it looks like gibberish, but it's supposed to be a code sequence. And actually, if you run it, it will output the words "Hello World."
Yes, I mean that's a rather simple program, but
that's good. Yeah. I don't know what they. That's good though. That's what Sherlock Holmes might have done.
Yes. Yep.
Moving right along to the news of the world. Mac Pro, wow, Ship date's now April. If you didn't order your Mac Pro from Apple, you might regret it. It's now 3 months out. What is there a theory on that, Serenity? Is it that they can't make them fast enough, or that people are buying them too much, or?
I think it's probably a combination. I mean, the Mac Pro is the first Mac that they have made in the U.S. in quite some time. And as a result, if there is more demand than they expected to have, it's entirely likely that their lines are backed up. Or it's possible that maybe some component went awry. We didn't really hear a lot about the Mac Pro from Apple during the last financial call, which I find interesting. I've got to assume it's either a problem with the shipping lane, or it's just been very popular and slightly more popular than I think Apple had initially expected. And also, I mean, have you seen those things? They look like they take a while to put together and
they're quite
make
beautiful.
Sure they're properly machined.
Yeah, it doesn't look like something some minimum wage worker could assemble. It really looks like
high-end machines.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I have one.
Oh, did you finally get one? I think the last time we talked, you were waiting on yours.
Mine came, and I have the box.
Just have it off screen.
Yeah, I have it. I've never opened it. I just keep it here. They're selling apparently on. Oh, here it is. They're selling apparently on eBay for a 50% premium. So, I'm thinking I could make a little money on it.
If you didn't mind waiting till April for your next one.
You think the eBay buyer would recognize this as a stack of gaffer's tape designed to look exactly like a Mac Pro? Maybe when he looked at the bottom, I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, gaffer's tape goes for a
This is expensive stuff.
That's a lot of gaffer's tape.
This is this is like $150 worth of gaffer's tape.
More than that. Probably $300. Ex-theater person here. I love my gaffer's tape.
Oh, you can't, you know, people talk about duct tape. Duct tape is nothing. Gaffer's tape. Now that's what you want.
Magical.
Did you see the Steve Jobs time capsule dug up after 30 years? This was buried at an Aspen Design Conference in 1983. He gave a talk in which he talks about future technologies somewhat similar to the iPad, Wi-Fi, and the App Store. He used his Lisa mouse to help navigate through the talk. And then he put the mouse into a collection of miscellaneous items donated by conference attendees that were then buried as the Aspen Time Tube. They lost it. They couldn't figure out where it's been. Somebody found it, and there's a video on CNET of the excavation. And here it is, 30 years later, Steve Jobs' Lisa mouse, worth actually less, if possible, than it was in the day it was buried. Nobody wants that. I don't even know if you could connect it to any modern hardware. It's pretty funny.
I doubt it, because everything on the Lisa was
totally proprietary, huh?
Yeah. Custom and a nightmare to connect to anything. So
there they are digging it up with a.
I'm moving dirt to loosen this thing up.
This is on a.
You guys are ready to pull this?
A reality show, right? Called. All right. On the National Geographic Channel called Diggers.
We did it. Look at that.
Out.
There's a show I want to watch.
Here it is. KG gets the sock. Makes the.
What? Remember time capsules were a big thing? Do people still do time capsules?
The end cap. Come right off in my hands. Holy crap! Holy
oh, oh, the drama.
Foot tube is packed full of nectar.
Of junk.
There's a little plastic bag in there. I reach in, I grab it. Look.
There's a GoPro in the tube.
Because I panicked like it was like a hot stove.
Couldn't be.
Okay, that's enough.
There it is.
Oh my God! It's a Lisa mouse. I've been looking for one of those.
Oh, my God. This thing.
You can see the entire episode on Diggers on the season premiere February 25th of the National Geographic. Potential value priceless. Potentially. Maybe not. Potentially. Actually, GoPro did a smart thing. I think that was a GoPro looking out right inside the tube. They decided to go public right after the Winter Olympics, and then they managed to make sure that every athlete at the Winter Olympics had a GoPro. So
they're nice little cameras.
They're great. I love them. I don't know if, I mean, they're marketed well. I don't know if they're unique hardware, but I have several GoPros.
Yeah, they're just built very well. I mean, they're very rugged for what their internals, and they're cheap enough that it's pretty easy to be like, yeah, I'll drop $300 on this HD camera that I can strap to myself somewhere and suddenly have video of whatever I want. Like, they have some use.
Brilliant marketing. They gave cameras to everybody, including the guy jumping out of the free fall, the Red Bull astronaut.
Stratos.
Yeah. They gave it to a loser. Let me see if I can find this in the Olympics. And if you ever thought about taking up the luge, you might not want to. This might discourage you. Let's see if I can find it. Matt Mortensen put it on his helmet as he went down. I guess they get up to about 130 kilometers an hour in these things. Here is the GoPro video on his helmet. From Sochi. Can I show this? Is this illegal to show? I don't think this is in any way imposing on NBC Universal's monopoly of the Olympics. God, this seems like a dumb thing to do. This doesn't look fun. That's, I guess, my problem. I like sledding. This doesn't look like it's fun.
I guess it's kind of like going down a water slide, right? Except you're on ice and...
And you're completely out of control and you're going 100 miles an hour. Yeah.
The luge doesn't scare me as much as skeleton. Skeleton is the crazy thing.
Going What's down skeleton? Face...
Skeleton is luge, only you're going down face first.
Oh, no. Bad idea.
Yeah. You didn't think it was scary.
Oh, when you were growing up, did you go sledding? Did you have a American Flyer sled and...
I lived in Los Angeles.
First time I saw snow was in 1991. So.
Really? No snow in India at all?
No. I mean, there is, but not where I grew up.
Right. What did you think? Were you like one of those dogs that see snow for the first time and you gingerly touch it and then you bounce up in the air?
No, I thought this was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. As long as you don't have to shovel it. I noticed you ended up in California.
Yeah, I think, and then you realize that, uh-oh. It can get pretty messy very fast.
Yes.
That's the problem with snow in New York City is it gets messy really fast.
It gets slushy and then it ices and then it freezes and then it refreezes and it's horrible. So good news, if you are intersex, you can now declare that on Facebook. I know it got a lot of attention for this. I guess in the past, the Facebook gender choice was male or female. Facebook has now allowed you to choose up to 10 different gender definitions out of 50 options. So there's 50 options, and then you could choose the one, 10 of them together. That seems very flexible. That's good, though. I mean, I think that's great. You can also choose your pronoun. I think that's great.
Yeah, it doesn't matter a lot to most of the population, but to folks who are trans or folks who are, right, you know, in the spectrum. And I mean, that's really valuable. And it's nice of that Facebook is openly recognizing that and being as friendly as they possibly can to folks who are trans or cisgendered.
Right.
You know, that's really awesome.
I think the big thing is that social networks have to be reflection of society and people who make up those social networks. So I think what Facebook is doing, I think other people should actually be actively thinking about adapting their social software to realities of human beings, right? Like, doesn't matter, you know, like what kind of service you offer. We all, it's just social software. This is made primarily for the people. So,
well, in fact, it's almost even offensive that they started off with so few choices, really. It is. This is my page. Shouldn't I be able to choose whatever I want?
I think kudos to Facebook for doing something.
Yeah, it's about time. Mark Zuckerberg, 2013's most charitable philanthropist, donated as much as $1 billion to charity in 2013, $990 million, by donating 18 million Facebook shares. That's pretty good. Although some have been a little more cynical about this, pointing out that, of course, it's a tax deduction and it makes you look good, and it does not replace federal funding.
No, but how can you... The people who are cynical about this make me mad because, yes, sure, it's a tax deduction for him. But the money is still going, presumably, to people who need it. And it is still going to fund lots of fantastic programs. It's like when people get mad about Bill Gates and his, you know, all the fundraising and the stuff that he's done. It's, you know, yes, you may disagree about maybe the kinds of charities that they're working with or that, you know, he's not giving away all of his money. But still, the fact that there is money going, being given away and being given to good causes is a thing to celebrate, isn't it?
Absolutely. As long as you don't get people in government, which you do, who say, okay, see, we don't have to do anything because we got Mark Zuckerberg.
That's not how this works.
Right.
I think the interest, I had a chance to talk to Mark about all this. And I can tell you, given that I have mostly written very skeptical articles about Facebook in my entire time covering the company, the one thing which impressed me the most about Mark was he actually genuinely believes in giving back, you know, and he believes that he's had a good fortune and he actually does want his money to actually impact people in a positive way.
Good.
It's not like some lip service or anything.
Yeah.
It's that he's actually a believer in this. And I think, you know, giving away $1 billion for whatever the reason is still giving away $1 billion. Like, how many of us actually give away a penny? Forget about $1 billion.
Right.
And I think you cannot mock somebody for giving away money to help other people.
It's difficult. In fact, Bill Gates always said this. He said, I'm reluctant to give away a lot of my money until I can spend the time I need to spend to make sure it's being used wisely. Because it's difficult. It's actually difficult to give away $1 billion and give it away appropriately. But Gates, of course, has been very active in going to other successful tech entrepreneurs and saying, are you going to do it too? He got Warren Buffett to give away most of his fortune and a lot of others. So that's good. Absolutely. Maybe don't send out a press release. Yeah, go ahead. Send out a press release if it makes you feel better. We're going to take a break. Cheap words. The article in The New Yorker saying Amazon's good for customers, but is it good for books? We'll ask that question of our panel. John Graham Cumming is here. Om Malik of GigaOm and Serenity Caldwell, MacWorld.com. Our show today brought to you by their folks at FreshBooks, a great cloud accounting solution that helps thousands of people like me, entrepreneurs, small business owners, save time billing, get paid faster, keep track of their receipts, keep track of their expenses and their time and hours. I started to, you know, I've been billing for years, you know, using WordPress or not WordPress, Microsoft Word or Excel to create the invoices. And it was just a pain. Some months I just would say, oh, I'm not going to do it this month. I'll do it next month. I remember sending a company a bill 6 months later and they said, we're not going to pay that. What are you crazy? That was almost a year ago. So billing is a big deal, and it was always a pain until Amber MacArthur, when I was up in Toronto, told me about FreshBooks. It was a startup in 2004, and I started using it, and it really was great. It was a lifesaver, made it easy to create invoices, beautiful-looking invoices, easy to get paid. I could send the invoices by email with a button on the email that said, Pay Leo. That really did help getting paid faster. It's more now. It's a complete cloud accounting solution. Lets you keep track of invoices, but also capture and track expenses on the go. Get real-time business reports with simple clicks. And you can try it right now free for 30 days. Visit FreshBooks. I'm sorry, getfreshbooks.com. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're still doing your invoices by hand, you got to check this out. Getfreshbooks.com, free for 30 days. And by the way, the delicious part of doing this, they're giving a birthday cake every single day to somebody who signs up for a new account, having heard it here on Twit. So when you sign up at GetFreshBooks.com, if you want to get in that drawing for the birthday cake every day, enter This Week in Tech in the How Did You Hear About Us section when you sign up. Give us a little credit, and you might get a birthday cake. GetFreshBooks.com. Did you guys read the New Yorker article? Amazon, of course... I've been fascinated by Amazon after having read Brad Stone's book, The Everything Store. Really interested in how it does business. The premise of this is that by making e-books inexpensive, by making books easy to get, Amazon has devalued the book. An independent publisher, Dennis Johnson, is quoted saying, Amazon has successfully fostered the idea that a book is a thing of minimum value. It's a widget. Does that seem reasonable? Is Amazon bad for books? It's bad for bookstores.
Yeah, it's definitely bad for bookstores. I don't necessarily know if it's bad for books. It certainly has created some problems in terms of books making excess profit. But it's been, I feel like it's been really good for, really good and really bad for ebooks. But it provided a huge market for independent writers.
That's what I'm going to say. Amazon is good for authors. Very good for authors.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent. I mean, there is the whole kerfuffle about everything going on in the ebook sphere and about, you know, agency pricing versus non-agency pricing and how much that's actually making authors. In the traditional publishing model, Amazon, you know, it depends on, depending on how much, how many books you are selling, Amazon can be great for you or be terrible for you. For the average author, I feel like Amazon's really great because it's an easy way for lesser known authors to really get the word out. And now that Amazon owns Goodreads, it's a way for them to sort of create a community and be able to touch base directly with their fans and their readers. That New Yorker profile, I'm of two minds. I mean, I build ebooks for Macworld, so, you know, I have a very big stake in that game. And while Amazon has done some great things for the books world and the ebooks world, it's also made, you know, it's made the paper book market a lot tougher. It's closed a lot of independent bookstores. I don't know if I can specifically go one way or the other about it. I have some good feelings about Amazon and what it's done for reading in general and for independent authors, and I have some really bad feelings about them as well.
Amazon uses the wholesale model, the traditional model, where they buy, at least for physical books, they buy books at the wholesale price the publisher authors, which is usually one half of the cover value, and then they set the price in the Amazon store, often undercutting their cost. Apple does the agency model. In fact, Steve Jobs, one of the reasons Apple got sued is because Steve Jobs was a little bit too vocal about putting Amazon out of business with the agency model, in which they charge 30% of the price and the publisher sets the price. They also, and then one of the reasons they really got in trouble, they also told publishers they couldn't set a lower price anywhere else. They couldn't sell the book for less anywhere else.
Or that they could sell them for less, but Apple could dock the price to that point if they did decide. If they were going to sell it for $7 on Amazon, then it had to be docked for $7, which is really, it was a huge problem because, again, as you said, Leo, the publishers weren't setting the price with Amazon's wholesale model. Amazon was buying the book for, you know, say $8, and then they were undercutting themselves, and they could be like, oh, well, to make this book really, you know, sell in lots of numbers, we're going to discount that book to like $6.99 or something like that. And when Apple came into play with the agency model, Apple's like, well, we want to sell all of your books at $9.99 so that you guys get, you know, the maximum possible money that you can get. But if Amazon decides to do discounting and Amazon's not on the on that model, we're going to be able to discount it right away. It's a most favored nation. Is that the right clause?
Yeah. You said Google is too big. Is Amazon too big? They're getting pretty dominant in the retail space.
Absolutely, and you're going to see them become even more dominant. And I think the whole books thing in which Apple got into trouble, I find it amusing that we are all beholden to Amazon when it comes to books. Like, they don't really have competition. They have perceived competition in Barnes & Noble and Kobo. And Apple, I mean, Apple iBooks is a joke. I think that's, it's like the new Cube. You know, remember the Cube computer?
Right.
Which looked so nice, but the
Apple does a lot of that stuff. New, beautiful things that nobody uses.
Exactly.
I have to disagree a little bit on iBooks. As a publisher for that, Apple has a decent amount of stock. I don't necessarily think that iBooks is the best reader around. But in terms of the back end and in terms of developing for it, iBooks and the EPUB standard is a whole lot easier for publishers and independent authors to build for than the Kindle's Mobi format and KF8.
I think
absolutely
book publishers, you know, went to Apple because they were terrified of Amazon. They're even more terrified now because iBooks has not become a big player in the same way that iTunes has become a big player in digital music. According to this New Yorker article, Amazon represents, for at least one major house, a third of their sales on any given week, headed towards about half. Independents, less than 10%. One New York editor said only a third of the 3,000 brick-and-mortar bookstores still in existence will survive if publishers don't waive their terms of payment. It's clear that Amazon's strategy is to dominate, sometimes by losing money on a product until they put the other guy out of business, and then they own it.
Walmart used to do that. I don't think they're doing anything different. I think the thing which we should talk about is that the publishing industry itself was loath to change or experimentation.
Right.
And it is full of so much sloth. And I think the people who complain about Amazon or Google or anybody, even Apple, are people who are middlemen, people who are getting squeezed by the efficiencies of the internet-based systems. And I think, Serenity is right. Like, this has been great for independent authors and writers. Look at a lot of interesting ebooks which are coming to market. Again, they haven't succeeded at scale just yet, but I do feel that the publishing industry has to blame itself for, finding itself in the position it is. Just like the music industry had trouble with itself, and they always blamed other people for their problems. And it's like, wait, technology is going to keep moving. You either get with it or you don't, and figure out how to get ahead of it. The books business hasn't. Like, even today you want, we live in a world which is so here and now, and a book publishing schedule is like almost 2 years to 3 years between commissioning to publication. And the whole process is so inefficient. And Amazon is essentially trying to eliminate a lot of these inefficiencies. And I think, Macworld can write like a really great piece about Johnny Ive or ebook about Johnny Ive and have it in the market in like a month. That's what readers ultimately want, right? They don't want to wait three years after some, big news events to wait for books to come. There's a lot of inefficiency in the system. So, we can't just blame Amazon for everything, I think the publishing industry has to look inwards as well and ask themselves the question as to like how they can improve.
Jeff Bezos always said that. He says, it's not Amazon. I'm just representing the internet, And the internet's going to put a lot of people out of business. Hey, let me ask you about this one, John Graham coming, because Cloudflare wrote about it. The 400 gigabit per second NTP amplification DDoS.
That's right.
Yeah, NTP is Network Time Protocol.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so what is this kind of attack? This occurred on Monday, but there have been more and more of these all the time.
Well, this is the latest in a long line of what are called amplification attacks, where people misuse protocols that are based on UDP. And what's interesting about a lot of these protocols is you can send a small packet and get a really big packet in response. And by forging where the packet's coming from, what you do is you send a packet looking like it's coming from the victim, and then some other server probably sends a massive packet to the victim. And these amplification things are really a problem because you can, as an attacker, you can have only a small amount of bandwidth at your disposal and suddenly turn it into 400 gigabits per second or whatever.
That's a lot of bandwidth. Probably. Very few people have 400 gigabits per second to spare.
Well, no, absolutely. And in fact, what happens is the pipes get clogged and you're then talking about fighting it off yourself and then going upstream and upstream and upstream to drop packets. But what's happened over the last, I would say, 2 months is NTP, which is the Network Time Protocol, has become very popular as people have realized that it has this enormous amplification factor. So you can get hundreds of times the bandwidth you've got available in the attack. And we've seen this one particularly big one on earlier this week at the 400 gigabits per second. And I expect we'll just see more because this is completely viable and something people can do if they've got a grudge or an axe to grind.
You have a diagram in the primer that you wrote showing how an attacker with a megabit per second, a 1 megabit connection, can then go to 10 compromised machines. You have to compromise those machines ahead or have them on a botnet. But those machines are then the trigger machines that because there's 10 of them, they have a gigabit per second. And then those go to 400 amplifier machines, which amplify it by 50 times. By the time you get to the target machine, you're talking 500 gigabits per second, all from a single megabit attacker.
That's right. Yeah, you can be sitting in a coffee shop somewhere, SSH'd into those 10 compromised machines, and then launch this kind of attack and take, you know, a site offline or an ISP offline or probably a small country.
What is the factor between the request packet and the amount of data that is delivered?
Well, it depends a little bit on the protocol, how large it is. In that blog post, I talk about that. The scariest one actually is SNMP, which has a 650x amplification factor, so you could get 650 times the bandwidth out through it. And a surprising number of devices have SNMP available on them on the internet.
Simple network management protocol. That's what's used to manage machines remotely over the WAN.
Yeah, that's right. And we have seen an attack using that. Now, NTP is a little bit smaller. It's in the 200 range, 200 times. The reason people like NTP is that NTP tends to be running on servers, and those servers have got really beefy internet connections. So you'll find that, you know, a server running in a university somewhere or in a business might have like a gigabit per second connection. If you can then fill that up with packets, then that's a good part of your attack right there. Whereas a lot of the SNMP stuff we've seen has actually been on home routers. So we actually saw one from Comcast some time ago where SNMP was used. So it's not just the amplification factor. It's how the machines you're using are connected to the internet. And NTP has become very popular because of the massive rate you can get out of it.
Is it possible to configure your NTP server if you run a time server to not be complicit in this?
Yes, absolutely. There's detailed instructions for all sorts of NTP servers. In the blog post I wrote, I linked to a lot of instructions for how to do that. And the other thing is that the underlying problem is the ability to do IP spoofing. Because we can do IP spoofing from anywhere, then we can have packets of any protocol appearing from anywhere on the internet. And there is a thing called BCP38, which is a best practice for internet companies to not allow IP spoofing on your network. Now, if that was introduced, all of these problems would disappear because spoofing wouldn't be possible.
This is kind of like raw sockets, or I guess in order for this to work, you have to spoof the server you want to attack, right?
Yeah.
And say, hi, give me a bunch of data. That's me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You say, hey, there's this website on Cloudflare that I don't like.
Right.
I'm going to pretend I've got its IP address because, of course, you can get that.
That's public.
It's not a secret. And then you say, right, well, I'm coming from here, you know, coming from that address. Here's a request. Of course, it didn't come from that address at all. That's the victim. And then the NTP server or the SNMP server says, oh, okay, here you go. Here's your response. And you do that with enough servers, then things have been, knocked over or receiving a ridiculous amount of traffic.
It isn't hard. Go ahead.
If people want to check if they've got an NTP server on the network, there's actually a thing called openntpproject.org, and you can put in your IP address or your network address, and it'll tell you if there is an OpenNTP server that you need to patch there. So if you go to openntpproject.org, that will help lock these things down. Even over the last week, we've seen about 100,000 servers get shut down. So please do that. It would help a lot.
And this issue of IP spoofing, how is it internet service providers, network administrators? Who needs to address that?
So it's really the people running big networks, so internet service providers, some very large organizations which have packets transiting through them, if they're their own, if they're essentially their own ISP.
Right.
So it's really something that, and it has to be done globally. The attack we saw, I think there's a map in that blog, in one of the blog posts we put. I mean, this was truly an attack coming globally, hitting us.
Yeah, from everywhere. How hard is there a reason not to block IP spoofing? Or is it just laziness?
Everything in the ISP business is about how much money you can make, right? I mean, it's very, very margin-thin business. So this is one of those things that is a bit of an externality. It's some spoofed packets are coming from your network, that doesn't necessarily hurt you directly. You might get hurt by packets coming from somewhere else. So there isn't an sudden incentive to do it. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is that the attacks are getting so big, and this one that we've talked about, you know, this week is enormous, that this really is essential that people start locking this stuff down. Because what we've seen is that pretty much anybody can be the victim of a DDoS, and the DDoSes are getting larger and larger. And that means that ultimately you will end up being a victim. And so,
and it's easy to trigger. So all you have to do is annoy a hacker.
Yeah.
Who was this big one against? Can you talk about that?
No, we can't, because the customer hasn't allowed us to say who it was. The previous biggest one we'd had on us was 300 gigabits per second, and that was against Spam House, the anti-spam organization.
Yeah, that was a very well-known attack. So when you say 400 gigabits per second, for how long?
That particular thing was running, I think, where it was bothering us, it was about an hour.
Jeez.
And now whether the attack may have continued longer than that, but you know, just looking at our own network graphs, we put in filtering and it was gone.
You were able to ameliorate it within an hour, but it could have gone on for longer.
I mean, what we often see is people either think there's a DDoS coming, that can be because someone's threatened them, or they're experiencing a DDoS, and then they'll sign up with us with Cloudflare, and we will then very, very quickly start protecting them. And, you know, we've now fought off some really big ones. I mean, 300, 400 gigabits per second.
How sophisticated do you have to be to launch this kind of a DDoS, an amplified DDoS attack? Can a script kiddie do it, or do you have to be a fairly sophisticated hacker?
I don't think you have to be very sophisticated at all. The amplification means you don't have to have that much bandwidth available. There are tons of NTP servers that are out there available. There is code on GitHub to launch attacks. So really, you don't have to be very sophisticated. The actual filtering of it tends to be a bit more sophisticated just because of the data rates you're dealing with.
Well, that's good news. I'm so happy we brought this up. Now, if you're not depressed yet, meet Mask, the most sophisticated malware ever, partly because it attacked Macs, Windows, and Linux users. And it probably was state-sponsored. It's yet another one of these viruses, these kind of omnibus viruses that are so powerful, like Stuxnet, like Flame. Remember we talked about this? That it seems like it's got to be a government that created this, particularly because of how it's used, who it attacks, the complexity of the attack, the fact that they want it to work even on mobile devices and any operating system out there. It seems like it's not economically motivated as much as it is perhaps espionage motivated and so forth. Do you know anything about Mask, John, or is that outside your...
I've also read the reports about it. I mean, in terms of these massive malware things, I mean, we obviously at Cloudflare we see these all sorts of malware attacking and scanning us and people
constantly
trying to break in.
Yeah.
Yeah, constantly. Actually, yeah, a couple of years ago, I looked at what percentage of the time we are under attack. And actually, it's now basically 100%. There's always something under attack somewhere on our network.
Right.
What we see actually a lot of is spear phishing. People trying
targeted
to get
attacks.
To us. Yeah, absolutely. Very, very targeted attacks. They'll send you links, making it look like it came from somebody else, making it look like it's something that is relevant to you just to try and break into the system.
Right.
And that, you know, that actually scares me in some ways more than really sophisticated malware, because people fall for that stuff and then they just hand over their passwords.
Right. Actually, Microsoft themselves recently published a report, a white paper that said that they estimated about 1 in 5 Windows accounts had been leaked by hackers, mostly because people reuse passwords. And if you search through the various databases of passwords from all these different systems that have been hacked, you find repeat, repeat, repeat. And they say about 1 in 5, 20% of all Microsoft passwords have probably been leaked now.
Yeah, I mean, that's not really a surprise. I mean, it's just amazing, actually, the amount of repeat passwords people use. I mean, they use the same password for absolutely everything. And no matter how many password leaks there are, they seem to keep using the same password. So I think it's sort of a, it almost shut their eyes to it and said, well, you know, there's so many millions of passwords being leaked, then my account is unlikely to get hacked, you know, probability wise. I'm one in 10 billion. Whereas, in fact, the reality is people would whiz through them and use them to send some spam or other things.
I read Bill Gates' Reddit AMA this week, so you don't have to. I'll give you the highlights in just a moment. We're going to wrap things up pretty soon. Serenity Caldwell is here from Macworld.com. Om Malik from GigaOm. Your hand getting tired holding that microphone? It's just flopped. It's just, it's on the ground now. John Graham coming from Cloudflare and many other places. The Geeky Atlas still out? Is it still available?
Of course.
Go love
to Amazon. Even if Amazon has devalued books, you can still buy it there.
Here's one book it hasn't. And somebody reminds me that Kickstarter, we all got emails, has been hacked. Its password database has been hacked. Although I think that the passwords, I hope, were salted and hashed and salted.
Actually, they said that they were salted with multiple rounds of SHA-1.
Good.
And that was their old system, and they changed to using bcrypt about 6 months ago.
So you're probably all right, right?
I mean, I would still change my password, but then, you know.
I did.
I'm paranoid.
I change them. You change them anyway. You know what? Get LastPass or KeePass or 1Password and just keep, you know, put strong, long passwords on everything, unique passwords on everything, and change them frequently. You don't have to remember them.
Yeah, and service providers, of course, can use something like Cloudflare to actually protect themselves. Because, I mean, everyone's getting hacked at this point.
It's amazing. Our show today brought to you by Squarespace. You've seen the Super Bowl ad. I mean, that when I saw that, I said, hey, they made it to the big leagues. The Better Web Awaits television ad where they showed all the junk, the clutter, them in real life that the web has become. Squarespace says you can have a better web experience, and everybody can if you use Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website, blog, portfolio. Squarespace sites are beautiful, they're clean, they're uncluttered, and they're easy to create. In fact, if you want to try it, just visit squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. You can use it for 2 weeks without any cost. You don't even need to give them a credit card or anything, and you get a sense of what Squarespace can do for you. That's hosting that just never goes down, plus the best content management system you've ever seen, giving you the greatest website ever. I actually really liked this ad. I don't know if it was one of the top ads in the Super Bowl, but I have to say it got your attention. It was every cliche, every dumb thing that you've ever seen on the internet, all wrapped up into one big ad. Create your great new website at squarespace.com. Use their importers to import to all of the best blog APIs into your new site so you can see what it would look like. That includes comments and images and links. If you like it, here's all I ask. Try it. Go to squarespace.com, use our offer code TWIT2 and get 10% off your new site. 25 beautiful templates to start with. The new logo creator tool, great for a small business or an individual that wants a logo with limited resources. The customer help has just been redesigned and it's the best ever. 24/7 support, live chat and email, help, self-help articles, video workshops. E-commerce is available on all subscription plan levels, even the $8 a month level, which is nice because if you have a nonprofit or you want to do a school fund drive, you could totally do that for $8 a month when you register for a year. Cash wedding registries. You get the free domain name with a one-year registration. You get to use the new Squarespace Metric app for the iPhone and the iPad so you can check your site stats, the blog app. Lets you post. The code is gorgeous. The back end is beautiful. They know what they're doing, and their hosting is second to none. I want you to try it. Go to Squarespace. 2 week trial available without a credit card. You don't need to use our code, nothing. But if you decide to buy, get 10% off by using the offer code TWIT and the number 2. Squarespace.com. A better web awaits you at squarespace.com. So Bill Gates has done a Reddit AMA before. This one, I'm not sure what prompted it, except maybe that he is now going to be spending one-third of his time advising Satya Nadella. Do you know Satya Nadella, Gom? Have you talked to him? Have you interviewed him?
I have, actually, on multiple occasions, and I think he's the right man for the job.
You do?
He's definitely one of a new breed of leaders. He listens. He cares for people, and he actually has very precise and concise ideas about technology, how it impacts Microsoft, and what Microsoft needs to do in the future.
That's, you know, awesome.
There is a very likely chance that he's going to surprise us in a good way in next few.
He's taken on what must be one of the toughest jobs, second only to running Yahoo, maybe, in the tech industry.
I mean, Yahoo is not really a job, right? I mean,
what is it, an adventure?
It's an arbitrage on Alibaba stock, so it's not
actually
really...
That's a really interesting way to put it. But the Alibaba, how much of the Alibaba?
They own enough that most of their stock valuation is essentially a proxy for Alibaba.
Holy cow.
Stock.
Alibaba, the search engine in China. If it does well, Yahoo does well.
Right. And I think my view on Microsoft is that Microsoft actually has a lot of products. They're doing really well in some categories. They have suffered pretty extensively in the personal computing space, and I'm not sure how they come back from that decline. But they are going to do pretty well in the cloud space, right?
That's the challenge, isn't it? Because they dominated the 80s and the 90s by creating a software platform that everybody used, 90% of all computers. And then suddenly the rug is pulled out from under them. They say Apple. They see the devices. Mobile takes over. The new platform is clearly cloud, but they've been beaten to the space by Amazon, by Google, by a lot of other companies. Do you think cloud is where their future lies, or is it in devices?
I think it's the cloud. I think cloud and cloud-based services is where they can actually start to have an impact. You think about it, for a company like Apple, they need, you know, cloud services, and they really severely lack in the cloud, cloud-based services.
They cannot do it.
Right, because it's just not part of their DNA. Whereas enterprise and building platforms for the enterprise is part of Microsoft DNA. There is a whole, you know, big wide world out there which needs a cloud service. And, you know, they're not all going to go to Amazon. A majority will go to Amazon, but there is a whole bunch of Microsoft-based enterprises out there. They need to find cloud, and Microsoft has a huge opportunity there. They've done a good job of building out a network and infrastructure. And I think deep down, they all know that they need to adapt to this new personal computing world where people don't pay for an operating system. People don't pay for applications or productivity applications or browsers and stuff like that. What people pay for is either the hardware or the services. I think with Nokia, they have a shot at hardware. I mean, I still remain very iffy about that. But on the services, the cloud-based services, they actually have a good shot. I think, you know,
they're late to the game. I mean, you've got Google is dominant, Amazon.
In cloud services?
Yeah. And
Amazon is dominant. Google is great with making, you know, pronouncements.
Doesn't everybody use Google Docs?
No, but it's not just Google Docs we're talking about, right? Like, we're talking about the actual infrastructure of the cloud, like, which is where Microsoft can provide a lot of upside.
Right.
I think they can't just think in terms of the number of people who want to still use Outlook and Exchange. And
that's
just
sad.
Hosting that on the cloud is a big business. I know it's sad, but there is people who want to do that. Right?
No, a lot of business. That's who wants it. And now, business hated Windows 8. Should Microsoft just abandon Windows? How important is Windows to this? It doesn't seem like it's at all important. The cloud doesn't require Windows.
I mean, I use two kinds of, you know, clients. I use iPad for pretty much everything. And when I really need something other than, like, iPad, I end up either using my MacBook Pro, which is what I'm using to communicate right now, or the Chromebook. I have a Chromebook, and I use that occasionally to write and do email and stuff.
Oh, you're not helping Microsoft at all.
No, I mean, like, why would I? Right? I'm pretty operating system agnostic at this point.
But you're the future. I think you're not alone. And I think Google's been smart seeding Chromebooks into education, and with a huge success in the last year. Those kids are going to grow up never having touched a Microsoft program.
I think the kids are growing up not knowing what it is to, like you look at the kids today, they're starting with the idea of a non-keyboard and a, you know, touch-based interface. That's their introduction to computing.
Right.
I mean, forget who makes it. You know, it's Android, Chrome, you know, or Apple. And I think that's the challenge. I think Microsoft is still caught between the past and the future. I think it's a pretty hard place to be. I think you see the same challenges for Intel. Like, Intel, too, is struggling to find its own, you know, future in this.
We're starting to lose you. I think Tony Bates is pissed off about your review of Satya Nadella. Can you unplug and plug in the audio interface to the USB port? Sometimes that fixes it. It's making this chattering sound, which we believe is a buffer overflow in the software. I don't think so. No. Yeah. Now it's even better.
Thanks for making it.
I fixed it. you're one of the few people I've heard who's bullish on Satya Nadella. I think a lot of it is we just don't know who Satya is, and he certainly comes from the enterprise and the cloud group. I mean, if you agree that that's the future for Microsoft, he's the right guy for the job.
Hey, could you unplug your computer if it's a laptop?
You think it's
horrible. Something weird is going on.
Bees have infested your microphone.
Tell you what, while you're doing that, Om, let's take a look at some of the things you may have missed this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit, Security Now.
A guy named Matt Vukas has, I think, very effectively demonstrated that Comcast is now throttling Netflix.
Triangulation.
Brett Martin, his most recent book, Difficult Men.
David Chase said to me that he was never 100% sure whether The Sopranos was a drama or a comedy. Father knows best how to kill people.
Know-how.
So you decided that for a Valentine's gift, we should build a, what is this, jewelry?
You know, the best kind of gifts are the ones that you build yourself, too.
Twit, we love you.
Hi, my name is Leo. Hi, my name is Leo.
Video. Hi. So I guess what we were saying is that because Satya Nadella came from enterprise, he came from cloud, he's the right guy if you're going to lead Microsoft into that new world. What happens to Windows, though? Om?
Yeah, you're asking me?
Yeah, what happens to Windows? Is it gone? Do you do a Windows 9 or do you just give up?
You know, it's sort of like what Apple is doing with its OS X, right? It just is on a path to being sunset.
So, but Apple has iPad and iPhone. What does Microsoft have to replace?
They need to figure that one out. Really quickly.
Yeah, like soon. Actually, Nokia, I like Nokia's products. I think they have a great range of products. It's just that the Windows phone system is behind. Doesn't have the apps. Doesn't have the mind share. It's actually a very good operating system, and the Nokia hardware is second to none. And nobody's buying it.
And that's probably a fair assessment.
Bill Gates says he uses a Surface 2 Pro. Doesn't have much choice. He can still jump over a small chair. Remember, that was his secret superpower when he was younger. He could jump over a chair from a standing start. And finally, he does the dishes every night at home because he likes the way he does it. And I just love the image of the richest guy in the world doing his own dishes. Those are all from the Reddit AMA. There's lots more to talk about, but gosh, we've gone on for hours and hours, and I think we're all tired now. So I'm gonna let Serenity go back to House of Cards.
I'm very excited to find out what terrible deaths deeds happen next.
Can I just say I'm only a few episodes ahead of you, and it gets worse.
I mean the first episode of the second series,
jaw dropping,
not giving away anything. Yeah, I'm like, do. They're not going to do that. Just did that.
And
it's
very
disturbing.
I'm just surprised that all of you have so much time on you.
I know what.
I was sick for a weekend.
I love. Like you can. I go home and I watch TV. That's all I do. I love it. True Detective, also very good. We'll be watching that later tonight as well. House of Cards, the thing I like about the first episode, because it's what's cool, what the thing that I like is a conceit that came from the British version of this, which is every once in a while he'll turn and address the camera and explain what's going on. Say, well, this guy, I'm going to get him. And he doesn't do it for most of the first episode. And you're thinking, what, did they get rid of that? And then he does.
They wait just long enough. Just it's long very enough. Charming. I don't know. Kevin Spacey talking directly at the camera. Him. I can get behind that.
Get behind that big time. We are working to get Kevin back on the show. We've interviewed him several times before to talk about that, but he's kind of busy, you know, going doing major networks, things like that. So thank you, Serenity. We appreciate you being here. I hope you feel a little bit better. I know you had a little cold. You sound fine. You sound great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hopefully it all goes away sooner or later. I've got a roller derby match later this week, so
try that's right.
Feel better.
That's right. I forgot you were a roller derby queen.
It's true.
What's your roller derby name?
R2 Detonate.
That's right. Thank you, R2 Detonate.
You're welcome.
Good luck on
the
match.
Glad to be on here, as always.
Oh, Malik, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us and for holding the microphone for the entire 2 hours. You did well. Very good. Always good to see you. And thanks to John Graham coming. Anything you want to plug? Obviously, the book is great, The Geek Atlas. The website for the movie, what is it called again?
Movie Code.
Moviecode.tumblr.net. Really awesome. Anything else?
Well, if you have a website, think about signing up with Cloudflare. There's a free plan, and you can get protection from attackers, and it'll be faster and distributed around the world.
We actually have been getting DDoSed quite a bit, but not on our website, but IRC. And I think people DDoS Skype, because if they can guess your Skype name, they can
find your IP.
Yeah. So I think we're getting a lot of that. I don't know if Cloudflare can help, but if it can, I'm calling you.
Send me an email after this.
Those script kiddies, it's just terrible. They got no sense of humor at all. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC on twit.tv. If you can't watch live, please do. But if you can't watch live, we've got on-demand audio and video after the fact available at twit.tv and wherever finer netcasts are aggregated, like iTunes. Please subscribe. You'll get it every week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another twit
this
is in the can.
Amazing.
Thank you there, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
Doing the twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby. Doing the twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby.